Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 22nd of April. Yesterday marked the 100th anniversary of the death of Mark Twain. Our guest this hour says that Mark Twain is not only relevant in 2010, he is alive and living on Wall Street. And you know what Mark Twain said about anniversaries. What ought to be done to the man who invented the celebrating of anniversaries? Mere killing would be too light. And so we will celebrate Mark Twain and the 100th anniversary of his death this hour. He was really quite a guy. Our guest this hour is Professor David Sloan, an English professor at the University of New Haven, author of Mark Twain as a Literary Comedian. Sloan is a great-grandson of Thomas Edison. He is past president of American Humor Studies Association and the Mark Twain Circle. And he is with us this hour to talk about Mark Twain. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as well. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email about Mark Twain, we welcome that as well. That is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Professor David Sloan, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Kathleen.
Yeah. And Mark Twain probably wouldn't like our celebrating the anniversary, would he?
Well, he was pretty clear about that Halley's Comet thing. So.
Oh, yeah. Talk about the Halley's Comet coming in during the year of one.
That his prediction was, I will come in. I came in with Halley's Comet, and I guess I will go out with Halley's Comet. And that suited his flair for drama. And, of course, he did it.
And he did it.
Sure.
That was amazing. And he did it. So you're a great-grandson of Thomas Edison. Ain't that something?
There's another guy with a flair for publicity. Yes, indeed. And Edison and Twain actually did meet. And Mark Twain said to my grandmother, Madeline, about whom I'm writing a book, when they met in 1909, your father thinks I am a very great man, and he thinks I am a very great, and I think he is a very great man, or words to that effect. But anyhow, it was that kind of wonderful double boast about reputations.
That's very nice. I bet you have a lot of stories, don't you, about, well, it's quite a lineage.
Well, Edison is an interesting study. He and Twain, Harvey Firestone, Andrew Carnegie were guys who were tremendously patriotic. They loved their country. They were real entrepreneurs, and they actually believed that entrepreneurialism and patriotism were almost identical. Because America in those days was still trying to upgrade itself as a producer. We were not yet a dominant power in the world. And these guys saw everything they did as something that would make life better for Americans and that would influence the world for the better.
Yes.
So they were really remarkable guys.
They were. Now tell me how a guy like Samuel Clemens, who worked as a printer, a steamboat captain, and a prospector, then reinvents himself as Mark Twain, an international travel writer, an essayist, a novelist, a humorist. That's quite a reinvention, isn't it?
Yes and no. He came from an interesting background, very strict, very cold Presbyterian father. So that'll give you the cold side of Pap Finn, maybe. And a very loving and almost daffy mother, who must have been absolutely wonderful, said to him later in life, I had two great fears when you were a child. One is that you wouldn't live to be an adult, and the other was that you would. So I think the humor was kind of hardwired in on Mark Twain from the start. And he actually went through something of an emotional crisis in San Francisco in the 1860s, just about the time of the Jumping Frog story, in which at one point he at least wrote about committing suicide or considering it.
That's hard to believe from a man like Mark Twain.
That he went to become a writer.
Oh, my goodness. And what was the crisis? Was it just a, was it a severe depression, or what was it?
He was hung up on a career decision.
Huh.
He had gone west to get out of the Civil War and get away from that. He identified the Civil War very early on, after he spent 2 weeks as a Marion Ranger in the Confederate Army, quote-unquote. That's sort of a funny story. That the Civil War was a bad deal and a bad thing for everybody. And then his brother Orion, or actually he's called Orion, got appointed by Lincoln to be Secretary of the Territory of Nevada. And Orion said, hey, come on with me, Sam. And Sam and Orion hopped in a stagecoach and went to Nevada. And that's when Sam Clemens starts working with his first, or well, actually his second newspaper. He'd set type since he was 10 years old in local newspapers like the Keokuk, Iowa Times. And he set something else around Hannibal. And I've forgotten the names of the newspapers, darn it. But anyhow, he'd been around the print trades from very early on as an apprentice. When he got to Nevada, things were wild and woolly and wide open, and he started attending the Nevada legislature and writing comic reports on the stuff that they were doing, which was, of course, bizarre, because those were bizarre times, and this was Nevada during the silver rush, you know, and all the mother lodes were coming in. There were boom towns everywhere, and Nevada was trying to get itself organized. In the meantime, back in the East, you've got the Civil War, whose guns are reverberating big time, actually, in Nevada and California. And there's a real question as to whether Nevada is going to try and support the Confederacy or the Union.
Hmm.
And so he's embroiled in all of this stuff, mm-hmm. and starts writing about it and discovers he's very funny.
Yes. And this political humor and this political insight also was nourished perhaps by his mother, or there was an interest in the political life in his family, or it was just something that he was interested in?
I think, well, the fact that Orion, his brother, was involved enough in Lincoln's campaign that he would actually get an office out of it. Would suggest that, you know, there was some interest in politics. And in those days, newspapers really existed for advertising and politics.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Hmm.
And humor columns, in fact, and story columns. So, you know, you couldn't get away from American patriotism, because the newspaper's column after column after column was a major speech about our manifest destiny. To move to the west with the setting sun, and America's natural strength and power and the future of democracy and all those things. It was everywhere. It was what people talked about.
Right. I'm wondering if you agree with this. A lot of people have said that Mark Twain was America's most influential writer, probably remains America's most influential writer. I'm wondering what that means and if you would agree with that description of him.
Yes, I do agree with that description of him. And two, I would say Adventures of Huckleberry Finn made the election of Barack Obama possible.
Oh, my. Well, let's talk more about that, sir.
That ought to stir up some listeners.
There's a sentence.
Well, I thought I'd just, you know, I might as well lay it out. So we've got something to argue about, you know, in good faith. I believe in making controversial statements is a good way to think.
Yes.
And the deal is this. Huckleberry Finn is a book that you might say is, well, it's against slavery. It's set in the South in 1845 to 1850, somewhere in there. But when it was written, it was first published in 1885. And slavery was not an issue in 1885 to the extent it was in 1855. Okay, so why would Mark Twain write a book about a slave trying to escape to freedom and all that? And, of course, he's not really. He's writing it about this kid, Huckleberry Finn, and that's the title, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And in those adventures, Huckleberry Finn grows up in an astonishing and unpredictable way. He is the son of a redneck. Hat Thin, in chapter 7 of that book, gets so drunk he comes in screaming about letting a, consider quotes around the word right. nigger when I use it,
mm-hmm.
because it's not a word that I, you know, that I would dignify with common use. But as a technical term, Mark Twain used that word in Huck's mouth 210 times, by my count.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big issues about that book is he uses the N-word so often, he must be a racist. No. But Huckleberry Finn is a person who believes totally in slavery, because that's all Huckleberry Finn has ever seen. This is a 10 to 12-year-old kid who's grown up in Missouri. You know, he's never been in free states.
Right.
He has seen the mild domestic kind of slavery, is what Twain described it as at a later time. And maybe we'll get back to that, because there's a wonderful statement he makes about his mother and slavery. But Huckleberry Finn is not an abolitionist. In fact, he thinks dirty abolitionists are a bad thing. So what Huckleberry Finn does is he has to run away from his drunken, alcoholic, psychopath father, and he ends up finding, guess what, a runaway slave on an island out in the Mississippi, and these guys find a raft, and they hop on the raft, and they start going down the river, and to his astonishment, Huck finds out that Jim, and he didn't know this, cares about his family just as much as white people care about theirs.
He's discovering his humanity.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. he didn't know that. You know, he thought, you know, slaves a piece of tractor. You know, they're farm implements. You know, they buy them and sell them, and, you know, they don't have any feelings. Who ever seen a slave with a extended family gathered around him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you haven't. So what's your assumption? Your assumption is, well, black people don't need that. Only white people have that. But, of course, the Southern system was to prevent that kind of generation of family, because a slave who is committed to a family is not necessarily concerned most about serving the master.
Well,
so Huck discovers all this, and it's very agonizing for him. And finally, he's got a choice. He can either rescue Jim out of slavery, because Jim actually gets, you know, sold to a farmer who, oddly enough, happens to be Tom Sawyer's uncle. And Huck has to say, am I going to leave Jim and forget about it, or am I going to rescue him? And he says, well, I see, I got to decide between going to heaven and going to hell. Because here I'm going to harm an old lady who owns Jim, who ain't done me no harm, and I'm going to do what God doesn't want me to do, which is become a dirty abolitionist. And Huck says, all right, I'll go to hell. And at that point, he's educated in a way that America took another 100 years to get educated.
And
he has finally realized that human beings have rights, and they come in more colors than just white.
And what was the response to that back in
1885? Well, interestingly enough, there weren't too many responses that particularly took up the racial aspect of the book.
Really?
Really. Huckleberry Finn... In the 1930s, people didn't talk much about Huckleberry Finn in terms of race. They talked about it in terms of the Mississippi River towns and the corruption of American society.
Hmm.
In the 1850s, the Russians loved Huckleberry Finn because they showed, look, this shows the ultimate decay of capitalism. You know, there were actually exchanges of essays that got into print in little booklets, Russians arguing with Twain scholars in America about that. What people said in 1885 was, this is an awful book for young people to read, because Huckleberry Finn is a terrible example. He lies, he cheats, he steals, he wants to wear raggedy clothes, he makes no apologies about these things. They're his nature. He feels a little bit guilty every now and then when he thinks about how the Widow Douglas and Miss Watson would feel about that stuff. But he's a terrible example, and then the book is full of violence. Pap Finn tries to murder Huckleberry Finn long about Chapter 9 or 10. Literally, he's chasing after Huck Finn with a clasp knife, locked in a cabin, blind drunk with the delirium tremens. That's not something you want your kid to read in 1885.
Hmm.
You know, that's a little heavy duty. On the other side, there are people like Joel Chandler Harris, you know, the beloved author of Uncle Remus, who says this is a wonderful book, and if anybody's been looking for the great American novel, this one may be it. And so there are other people who are saying this is a different and unique book. It's the American place and the American voice with the very best of the American vision of democracy.
And does it remain, would you say, Professor Sloan, the great American novel?
Well, it depends on your criteria, but my answer is you bet. It does treat the American place in all its uniqueness. Of course, there's the mighty Mississippi River, which is about as symbolic an American thing as you can get, next to Niagara Falls. You know, that was slightly bigger brag, but the Mississippi is longer. And there's that. And then there's the dialect. And here's Huckleberry Finn, who is really talking Pike County, middle American, low-class dialect. There wasn't a book in our literature where a character had done that from first page to last.
And how did Twain hear that? Where did he pick that up?
Yeah, he picked it up right on the spot. Huh. It was everywhere you could go in Hannibal Moe. All the low-class kids he played with, the model for Huck Finn, Tom Blankenship, probably spoke pretty much like Huck Finn is supposed to sound. And, you know, with all the slur and all the little bits of Southern accent, you know, all that kind of stuff. So,
right.
No, it's on the spot. Twain worked very hard on accents and, in fact, prefaced Huckleberry Finn by saying, you'll hear Negroes speaking in several different kinds of dialects. This is not an accident. This is because there are several different kinds of dialects to hear.
Professor David Sloan is our guest. We are talking about Mark Twain, yesterday marking the 100th anniversary of the death of Mark Twain. Professor Sloan is an English professor at the University of New Haven, author of Mark Twain as a Literary Comedian. And our guest is also a great-grandson of Thomas Edison, past president of the American Humor Studies Association and the Mark Twain Circle. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, we have a ton of phone calls. Let's start with Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. My question is, and I think I've got two, but where did Mark Twain get the idea for Tom Sawyer and whitewashing the picket fence and conning those other kids into thinking it was a privilege and getting them to pay him for doing it? How many coats of whitewash did he put on that fence before he ran out of whitewash? That
I like
got
that.
To be a classic.
I'm not sure, but I have a suspicion that Twain probably was told to whitewash somebody's fence when he was still young Sam Clemens and difficult to get to do whatever mom wanted him to do, which he never did. And that's part of it. And the other part is, I think, the idea of this incredible scam he's running. He learned from Bear Stearns.
Also, too, where did he get the idea for the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County?
Well, that is supposed to be a true story. And there is an angel's camp in California. And the person who was supposed to have sent Sam to hear that story, or Mark, was named Artemus Ward. He's mentioned in the, you know, the first paragraph of the book. He was a real humorist. He and Mark Twain had a big drinking bout together in Virginia City, and Artemus Ward tried to get Mark Twain to come east with him to said he was wasting himself in the sagebrush, and later wrote back and said, have you got anything for me to put in my book, Artemus Ward Among the Mormons? And the thing Twain had to put in his book was the notorious jumping frog of Calaveras County, which he wrote up and sent to Ward. And it got there too late to go in the book, so Ward handed it off to a friend, got published in a newspaper, and all of a sudden, it just exploded, spread all over the country, and everybody laughed. It was just screamingly funny.
Thanks, Eugene, so much for your call. We go next to Scott from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I was telling John when I called in, I'm upset because if this program had been on 24 hours ago, I would have been calling from my little boat, which I would say my raft on the Mississippi.
Oh. But,
I mean, yeah, timing is everything, huh? Anyhow, the question I had is that a couple years back, I took a trip that I found really wonderful. I went down to Hannibal, and while I was down there, I ran across something that I think said that the real person that he based Huck Finn on, was it Tom Blankenship, maybe, wound up being a judge in Montana Territory or someplace like that. And I just wondered, I mean, it sounds like from the kind of that kind of origins to wind up doing that. He must have been quite a character. The real guy must have been quite a character anyway, and I wondered what information you had on that.
About the same, actually, John, you're very well informed. About the same amount of information you have, which is I've heard that same story. I'm inclined to think it possible. In those days, not every judge had to go to Harvard Law School. Or Yale. In those days, a lot of judges came to the post without a heck of a lot of formal training. And it could well be that he got interested in the law and studied the law in somebody's law office. You know, Tom Edison got to start that way. Tom Edison was a lower middle class, the middle class kid, and he rushed onto a railroad track and pulled the telegrapher's child off the tracks, and the young telegrapher's child did not, therefore, get run over by an oncoming train.
Mm.
And the telegrapher was so grateful, he said, well, what can I do for you? And he ended up teaching Thomas Edison telegraphy. And from telegraphy, Thomas Edison got into senders and receivers and carbon. And from carbon and senders and receivers, he went on to light bulbs, the phonograph, and everything else. But he was considered retarded when he was a child.
Ah.
You know, they actually, his mother had to pull him out of school.
So you were actually celebrating the anniversary yesterday on the Mississippi intentionally, Scott?
Well, I didn't realize it was the anniversary.
Oh.
Being on I just go out in the backwaters and there's something about that river that is just magical. Mm-hmm. I can see why Clemens loved it so much, and it's really fascinating around Hannibal too, because you can see out to those little islands out there where he based a lot of those adventures. So wonderful time! I recommend it highly to Hannibal, to everyone.
All right,
thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah.
Scott, before you go, I've got a piece of homework for you.
Uh-oh, okay.
You were talking almost lyrically about the Mississippi. Mark Twain, of course, wrote up the Mississippi River in Life on the Mississippi.
Yes,
and
indeed.
There are a couple of passages in that where he talks about the beauty of the river and how gorgeous it is. And then he talks about becoming a pilot and how then all the beauty of the river became something else, became something he worked with as tools. And he said, in some ways, the beauty had gone out of the river for him because he knew how frightening some of the prettiness was because it represented sunken logs to kill a steamboat. But anyhow, there's some wonderful passages in Life on the Mississippi. I don't know if you've read it, but if you haven't, you've got a treat coming.
A long time ago, and yes, I agree entirely. It is it's a real magical book.
Hmm. Yeah.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks so much for the call. I didn't know this. I guess I should have known this, but the name that he took, Mark Twain, I was reading yesterday, means 2 fathoms, about 12 feet of water, a safe depth for the steamboat.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew that. That's Mark Twain.
Yeah, it was the pen name of an old windbag who used to write columns in St. Louis about the Mississippi River. Was it St. Louis or New Orleans? Some fact checker is going to have to check that one. And he signed himself Mark Twain, and Mark wrote a very joshing column and more or less embarrassed this guy right out of the business, and actually felt bad about it later on. And so he took up the name. And I don't know whether that was started partly out of a little bit of guilt or whether it was just the perfect name. It is a great name.
It is a great name, isn't it? Mark Twain.
Yeah, it's strong in the right places. It's got that K sound right in the middle, and you know, the K to the T. It's poetry. Right there, Samuel L. Clemens, I think, would probably not have had quite as big a career as Mark Twain.
You're absolutely right. All right, let's go to Tom from Green Bay. Hello, Tom.
Good morning to you both. It's a pleasure to talk to you. First, I would like to say that Twain is one of my favorite authors. I think that he is extremely relevant still today in the 21st century. And most importantly, he remains eminently quotable. My question to you, Professor, is regarding the progression of Twain's writing to go from a very funny story like the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County to an essay like The United States of Lyncherdom, which is very witty, but it's very scathing. And then to go from that to a late novel like The Mysterious Stranger, which is pretty grim and embittered, and then he becomes something pretty much of a misanthrope. So my question, I guess, is what is your opinion of this progression? How or why do you think that his writing changed in this way?
Oh, that's a $64,000 question, and a very good one. The Jumping Frog is underrated as a story that has meaning because it is loaded with meaning about entrepreneurialism and democracy, egalitarianism. And in some ways, it's a spoof of being foolish about those things. And that's why Jim Smiley gets taken to the cleaners by a stranger.
Uh-huh.
And so there's, you know, Twain is a thinking writer always, and my contention has always been that a lot of his humor is, in fact, his ethics, and it's just disguised as jokes because that's the way it popped out of him.
I see.
The United States of Lyncherdom, he actually wrote that part up for Life on the Mississippi. That popped up as a chapter in there, and he took it out, or his publisher actually took it out, but Twain acquiesced. And the reason he acquiesced is the chapter was too bitter to go into that particular book.
I did not realize that that was a part of that book.
It was indeed, and it also got sort of revised a little bit into a speech by another murderous psychopath, Colonel Sherburne in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Says essentially the same message as that missing chapter of Life on the Mississippi in the United States of Lyncherdom.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Twain's been thinking about all this stuff pretty much all his life. You know, I won't say he jumped like Athena full-blown from the head of Zeus, but he shows up as an ethical thinker and comedian from almost the very start. They used to talk about him as a moral humorist in Nevada in the 1840s, I mean the 1860s, and that's what one of the reasons Artemus Ward went out there to meet him.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and about the misanthropy, Mysterious Stranger is a tough book. I just had the honor of being invited to contribute to a whole book on the Mysterious Stranger. I did my little essay. Number 44, The Mysterious Stranger, the Centennial Edition, a University of Missouri Press has published it. And if you're interested in that book, you know, Mysterious Stranger, you'd love the book of essays. And he never published The Mysterious Stranger because he could never get it quite the way it needed to be. And one of the things he tries to do is he tries to lighten it up with a lot of humor. And he borrows a lot of jokes, and he borrows a lot of political sarcasm. He makes fun of Boston, and he makes fun of the Christian Scientist. He plays around with Missouri cooking from the 1845 to 1855 period. Does all those things get thrown into this book that's supposed to be about medieval Europe. And he just can't make it work. And, yeah, he has become somewhat sadder and wiser about the indecency of human beings and the way they treat each other.
Well, he's also had some personal loss, right, in his family?
Lots.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I hope not to ever have to say that I've duplicated Mark Twain's life. Three of his four children and his wife predeceased him. And, in just dreadful ways. And he had a very strained relationship with the fourth daughter. So, he got buffeted by fate. Let's say he also went broke a couple times, and had to be rescued from that by a guy named Henry Huddleston Rogers, who was very helpful and very smart and sort of took Mark Twain over and managed his life for 5 or 10 years and brought him back to solvency. But, he really suffered a lot. So, yeah, there could be some dark vision in there. But he also suffered on behalf of mankind. He had empathy for slaves.
Yes.
And there's his short story, A True Story, in which he describes a listener named Mr. C, and that couldn't possibly be Mr. Clemens, I guess, who is lectured by Aunt Rachel about her days in slavery. And the thing is, Mr. C had no idea of the suffering and heroism. And so Aunt Rachel sort of lays it out in front of him. And, of course, in doing that, Twain then lays it out in front of us. And that was, next to Notorious Jumping Frog, that was his most important short story. And still a major accomplishment in American short story writing.
Yes.
But, we all had to learn to think that way. That was not the way people typically thought in 1875.
Thank you, Tom, for the call. Let's go to Tina next from Wausau. Hi, Tina.
Hello. I just wanted to add a little comment. My husband and I have always been a huge fan of Mark Twain, and a couple of years ago we took a trip to Hannibal with our two preteen daughters, thinking they would think it was just the most boring thing in the world, and they loved it. We listened to Huckleberry Finn all the way down there on tape, and we had a great 2 days there. It was so nice. So anybody, interested in this, it's a great place to take your family.
I went and saw the Hannibal outfit, I think around 1965 or 66, and then I got to go back about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was just breathtaking how the professionalism had made that a museum that was both interesting and exciting and accurate. It was just astounding. Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a marvelous place for a family to go visit, so I'm very glad you said that. And is it within driving distance of Wisconsin? Do I know that? It took you 2 days to get there, I guess, right?
Are you there, Tina, still?
Well,
yeah,
Tina's
she's
gone.
Gone.
But anyhow, that's a nice puff and well-deserved. So
yes.
I'm very glad Tina called that in.
Yeah. Sandy from Mineral Point, hi.
Hi there, Kathleen. Enjoying your show greatly.
Good.
I have two things I wanted to talk about. One is I want to ask your guest about Mark Twain's fascination with Joan of Arc. It's sort of very interesting and sort of a different focus for Twain. And secondly, I just wanted to mention that in Mineral Point, at the reopening of our opera house on the 7th of May, which is Friday, we're doing Jim Post's one-man show, Mark Twain and the Laughing River. And it's a wonderful, wonderful evening. I've seen Hal Holbrook do his show live twice, and Jim Post's show on Mark Twain is equally entertaining. So that's an opportunity for people to get a little more Twain during this 100th
Great.
Anniversary.
Great. Professor Sloan?
Well, first, I'm not sure I've ever seen Jim Post. I've seen several Mark Twain impersonators, and one of the things that impresses me most is a lot of them are extremely good. So let's puff that show. It's May 7th, and I encourage people to go, too. And Joan of Arc.
Joan of Arc. He wrote a book about Joan of Arc, and it was a very serious book. The other thing I wanted to say about the performance, and Jim Post has been acclaimed across the country by the Smithsonian, incredible reviews from the Washington Post and the Chicago Sun-Times. So he's quite well known in this sort of region, I think, as well.
And historically reputable, I think, which is the thing you really care about. What you want is somebody who is representing the kind of thinking and the kind of experience that Twain himself brought people on the lecture platform.
Right.
Exactly.
He was a very serious, funny lecturer.
Do you want to comment on Joan of Arc, his fascination with her?
Well, you know, Joan of Arc to him represented purity. And purity was not something that he saw a lot of in other places. And she was, of course, betrayed by men. And she was, of course, visionary and doing what she was doing for patriotism and for the welfare of the French people. She had a lot of the kind of the core values that underpin Twain. And so that's important. And the other thing is that Joan of Arc reminded him of his daughter Susie, who he worshipped and who also died at the age of 19 or thereabouts, while the Twain family was in Europe. And that was such an astonishing tragedy that to some extent it drove them out of Hartford. They never really went back after that and colored the rest of the family's life. So there are a couple of good reasons why he would be interested in Joan of Arc. Unfortunately, I'm not sure his writing about it ever gelled into the kind of book that lots and lots of people would want to read. You know, he tried to make it funny, but it just didn't get funny enough.
Thank you so much for your call. We go to Jim from Galena next. Hi, Jim.
Hello?
Yes, hi, Jim.
This is too weird. I'm on my way to do my Mark Twain show for the 200 librarians down in Moline.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, no.
And I'm just enjoying the Dickens out of the show, of course. And then this woman, God, this is too strange.
Jim, this is Jim Post.
In my research, Sam one time said, and I made Tom Blankenship, who was his hero and actually his protector, because he was such a tiny, he was a small prematurely born fella, and he says Tom Blankenship never did learn how to read, so I don't suppose he even knows that he's my Huckleberry Finn, but he did okay. He moved out to Montana where he became a judge, but he never said he learned how to read, and I think it would be possible, him, Tom Blankenship being such a fine, heartfelt person, he may very well been chosen to be a judge in Backwater Place there just because of his honesty, which of course he didn't get until he was an adult. Just a thought. And my favorite book is a book that was, I forget who wrote it, but her name was Katie, who was a servant in the Sam Clemens house for 35 years. And a woman wrote a book about her sayings and her knowledge of being with the Clemens, and it's, I'm sure our guest has read that book. It's just overwhelming, amazing to the inner workings of that household. Anyway, thank you for the wonderful show, Kathy.
Thanks.
And by the way, to tell him, you could get Jim Post CDs, the one CD, Laughing River, won the American Library Association Award. So just a little pat on my back. But nevertheless, I love performing Mark Twain, and I have music in my performance. And keep doing it, Don. You do a great job.
Thank you, Jim. That is ironic that the next caller happened to be Jim Post, Professor Sloan.
Yeah, now let me pick up on Jim Post for a minute and Hal Holbrook. Once you've listened to a narrator or presenter like Jim or Hal Holbrook, you really read Twain in a different way. Twain is much more awesome read aloud. And that's why I'm impressed, too. I guess it was Tina who you know, went with her family down to Hannibal and listened to Huck Finn on tapes on the way down. I suspect that that was awesome and really contributed to their experience.
Right.
Likewise, a true story. I don't think anybody in your listenership could read a true story out loud in the middle of their living room and not break down in tears at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that way.
Mm. Thank you, Jim, so much for your call. We're talking about Mark Twain this hour of the program, and our guest is Professor David Sloan. Yesterday, the 100th anniversary of the death of Mark Twain, and our guest, Professor Sloan, English professor at the University of New Haven, author of Mark Twain as a Literary Comedian. Our guest is past president of the American Humor Studies Association and the Mark Twain Circle, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to give you the email address as well if you'd like to join us in the final minutes of our program. It's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We go to Randy next from Madison. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. Great show. Let me quick preface my questions by saying just the other day I emailed a friend, and this is a friend who used to read me Mark Twain over the phone all the time. And in talking about one of the situations, I was able to quote Twain to him one of my favorite quotes, which is that it's easier to stay out than to get out, which tells me that Mark Twain is, you know, 100 years after he's dead, he's still in the American atmosphere. The questions I had, first, considering all his writings about God, I wonder if he self-identified himself. If you self-identified as an atheist. And second, 25 or 30 years ago, when I was at school, my best professor ever, Norton Kinghorn, gave a faculty lecture on Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, and really opened my eyes, because he made it sound like the thing was an absolute contemporary satire. It was sort of his fictional version of the Gilded Age, because he was going after so many of the robber barons. I just want to know if that jibed with your reading.
Randy, I think you're right there where I am. The Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Even William Dean Howells in 1890, when he reviewed it, said, "This thing bounces back and forth between King Arthur's Court and our time. This is about, capitalist barons and labor unions trying to get their rights, and it's about corruption and craziness." And yeah, he said, I as he was reading it, Howell said, "I kept batting back and forth between medieval England and America." So yes, very much, I think it's that kind of thing. And Connecticut Yankee himself, of course, is probably modeled on P.T. Barnum, which was also, he was a major entrepreneur. And by the way, P.T. Barnum, for those who don't know it, was also a major idealist and believer in rights for minorities, and gave a lecture in favor of votes for blacks on the floor of the Connecticut legislature in 1866. And the Connecticut legislature did not, in fact, vote to give votes to black people that year. It was another year or two before they got enlightened enough to follow P.T. Barnum's lead. And that's the kind of personality that Twain was trying to get into Hank Morgan, the Connecticut Yankee. So, yeah, very much. It's a modern book. Unhappily, because, of course, the book ends with the Connecticut Yankee being defeated by the forces of ignorance.
Yes. Yeah. I was reading an interesting article about Twain yesterday, that about his literary critic talents, and that he's less known, but certainly is no less talented as a literary critic. This was about his library and his hundreds of personal books and his commentaries, which could be quite savage on some of his contemporaries, but that he wrote a lot about politics, religion, history, the arts, and science in the form of criticism.
Well, he writes a lot of essays.
Mm-hmm.
He sure does. Of course, he's got so many letters that they'll never collect them. There are thousands and thousands of letters, which are maybe his best expression. But he does think as an essayist too. He does think about style a lot. He wrote How to Tell a Story. He talked about the craft of writing fiction and jokes about himself as being a jackleg novelist in Those Extraordinary Twins, which is the second half of Pudd'nhead Wilson. And, of course, lots of people know about Fenimore Cooper's literary offenses when he takes on Cooper's romanticism and goes to town on that. So, yeah, he had plenty to say about his craft.
Mm-hmm.
He's a conscious craftsman.
Thank you, Randy, for your call. Bruce is next from Oshkosh. Hello, Bruce.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Dave, for the work you're doing. It's going to add years to your life. Let me just explain.
I think so, too.
I started reading Mark Twain under the blanket with a flashlight when I was 7 back in 1944.
Oh, wow.
And my kids have done the same. I've had 7 kids. One of them is 7 years old, and he loves Mark Twain. I wanted to mention also Life Without Cussing. I know that's not a story, but it's changed my life from Mark Twain. As I was reading Huckleberry Finn and others, Life Without Cussing, I've actually taught my kids not to swear. And then locally, it opened my mind and heart to people from around the world and got me involved in Black Thursday sit-in here at UW Oshkosh, where the 98 black students sat in to protest their the way they were being treated and not getting financial aid, and they were all expelled, and I worked to get them back in.
Oh.
I've also worked with students from Red China and Sri Lanka as they were refugees and gotten Senator Nelson, Senator Proxmire to sponsor their citizenship. So let's give it to Mark Twain. Yes, Forces of Ignorance, oh, my God, 2000 and 2004, you both know how Forces of Ignorance took over the USA. Oh, excuse me, that was too political. Well, anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bruce, for the call. Professor Sloan?
Well, you know, there are a couple of ways. First, I think I admire what you did for those black students because Mark Twain himself sponsored a black student at Yale and paid his tuition.
Did he really?
At Yale Law School.
Huh.
Yeah, and Thurgood Marshall was one of the tutees of that black law student that Twain sponsored.
Oh, that's a wonderful story.
So, you know, Twain was aware of the value of education and sponsoring black people's education to right the wrong of slavery, basically,
mm-hmm.
he said. And as for the other parts of it, you know, you look at Twain's feeling about robber barons and the obscenely wealthy, and you look at the kinds of salaries that are being taken out of
Righto.
The economy by the people who are running major financial institutions and major corporations. And you think of the boards of directors of these corporations where, you know, some of these boards of directors pay their directors $250,000 a year. And guess what? They don't protest
right.
about these obscene salaries. So, you know, we're not right now in an era where Twain would be having a field day at the kinds of moral and ethical corruption.
He sure would. And the only person who I can think is doing this in a humorous fashion but has the same kind of moral humorist is John Stewart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, Twain's a tough act to follow.
Right, exactly.
You're never going to see a whole lot of Twains around.
Right, but the outrage and the being able to just hit the nail on the head with all of this, which not too many people are doing, and it is something to be outraged about.
Yeah, I think Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes,
was
Kurt Vonnegut.
In that direction.
Uh-huh.
I remember he used a phrase once talking about the farmers general of the human condition and their man-made weather of economics and war. And, you know, so he also had that kind of dark vision of people who had money and power and used it badly instead of well.
Yeah, right. Well, this has been fun. Thank you so much. Thanks to Thomas Edison for your being born, too. He was part of the chain, huh?
I hope.
Yeah. Thank you, Professor Sloan. I enjoyed the hour.
Kathleen, it's been an honor. Thanks. I really appreciate having a chance to appear with you.
Oh, our great pleasure. Professor David Sloan, English professor at the University of New Haven, author of Mark Twain is a Literary Comedian. He is the great-grandson of Thomas Edison, past president of the American Humor Studies Association and the Mark Twain Circle. We thank him so much for being with us yesterday. Because Mark Twain didn't like anniversary, we marked the 100th anniversary of his death the day after that anniversary, which I think is appropriate. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. A couple of reminders. One is that we are on Facebook. I feel like we're just so terribly modern. So if you want to post comments about Mark Twain, your favorite quotes from Mark Twain, that would be fun. Feel free to do that. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Our email address is, in case you didn't get through with your request for the open line, Dunn K, also Fanning, also Peace, and then we're all at WPR.org. Bill Nye, the science guy, is with us next Tuesday to talk about meteors in space and more. Thanks, everybody, for listening.